It's really great to see such an overflow crowd this morning. If we could try to get our coffee and find some corner to curl up in and try to be comfortable. This morning, Dr. Jean Garten is our guest. She's an eminently qualified person to be speaking to us on our topic for this morning, which, as you know, is how to counsel people in regard to the topic of abortion. In the field of abortion, Dr. Garten has worked extensively, being one of the founders of the Lutherans for Life organization, as well as its current president. Dr. Garten also has served our Synod in many capacities. She is the wife of a clergyman of the Missouri Synod. She is currently involved in three capacities officially with the Synod. She serves on the Synod's Board for Communication Services. She is on the Social Concerns Committee of the CTCR, and she is currently chairing the Committee on Men and Women in the Church, which is a committee of the LACUSA organization. So we're very glad to have Dr. Garten with us this morning. I told her that I would keep it brief because she has many things to tell us and our time is short. There will be time for questions and answers at the end, so if you could save your questions for at the end. Thank you very much, Dr. Garten.
Thank you. It's very, very good to be here, and I want to really commend the committee. When I was invited for this particular day in February, I said, oh, I'll come if you can guarantee that you will not have snow. I mean, did they do a job? 50 degrees? But the reason you don't have snow here is because I have it all in New Jersey. 24 inches in 8 hours last week. Everything shut down. Meetings were canceled. Families huddled together in one room. The snow didn't cancel the week, though. The winds did. The winds of war. Right? The whole country dropped out. And I wondered as I watched as much of it as I could, what the fascination was about it. And it seemed to me that we are so preoccupied with war at this very moment that to look back on that war brought a kind of romance to it. It was so simple. You knew all the bad guys. They talked in subtitles. You knew all the English. They never moved their lips. Churchill, even without his cigar, you'd recognize because he always said something famous. And there was no such thing as sex then. There was romance. And when a woman went to bed with a man that wasn't her husband, she suffered great pangs. And that's all you saw were the pangs. Unlike today. And then finally, the 18-hour marathon was over, concluded with the invasion of Pearl Harbor and America's entry into the war. And already there are rumors that there's to be a sequel. And I have a hunch that we will win that war. But that's something we understand very well. War, what it is, what it does, ask any child to define war. Defining peace is far more difficult, for we don't have good, powerful symbols for peace. You define peace. Would you say it's the absence of war, freedom from controversy? Those are all negative ways of defining war. Or perhaps if you were looking for something positive, you might say that peace is the cessation of pain, the condition of feelinglessness. But peace defined in that way could equally apply to death. So then, is war so vivid in our minds that we have no positive sense of peace? Is there no symbol that embodies the elements of peace in our time? I would propose there is. Peace described in the most positive terms, in a manner which connotes life, is most clearly seen in the relationship of the unborn child with its mother. For 9 months, each one of us knew, in the most biblical and most unifying sense, what it was to be at peace. We had the tranquility of being in proper relationship with our universe. Birth is a disruptive process in that peace, but it's part of the natural order, and even birth is symbolic of that which is good, something new, something filled with hope. But abortion and the acceptance of abortion in the mind of a society destroys not only the peaceful existence of the unborn child, but it also destroys the deepest and most peaceful form of human coexistence that is possible in a fallen world. The war on the unborn in this country in the last 10 years alone has claimed more lives than all of the other wars put together that we have fought in our national history. And what we are going to talk about today might well be entitled, a la television, The Wounds of War. And I'd like to begin by reading you one of many letters like this I have received from a young woman who had read the book I had written, wrote to me by way of the publisher, signed her letter with the letter C, and provided a return post office box in California. Before I was a Christian, while I was under indoctrination by the popular culture, which trivializes the life of the unborn while promoting the rights of the pregnant woman, I had an abortion. Since that operation, I have experienced guilt, confusion, sadness, self-disgust, fear, and anger at myself, at the unborn child, and at God. No one told me I would undergo this kind of pain. I was led to believe that the abortion would cure everything, solve my problem, and be an efficient operation quickly done and as quickly forgotten. How untrue. Yes. The physical procedure was fast and efficient, but I have not found an efficient way of disposing of my reactions and feelings as easily as I arranged for disposing of the womb contents. As a Christian, I realize that guilt is godly if it produces repentance, but that repentance requires a change of action. So the guilt I feel over my past action is useless, since I cannot revoke the decision I made, nor bring back to life the baby I destroyed. So guilt and depression remain. Suppose you had received that letter. How would you respond? Certainly to her skewed understanding of forgiveness, of grace. Perhaps you would say, she's not a Lutheran or she'd have that straight. But I'd have to tell you, on the basis of those comments, I could not conclude that she was not a Lutheran, for I have heard the same thing from many of the women in our own fellowship. You're right, though, she is not a Lutheran. But if all you heard was that doctrinal distortion, and if that was all you responded to, you would have missed the mark. For what you had to say, she would not hear. For you had not heard what she did not say. Here is a woman experiencing such isolation, such pain, such distrust, that she chooses as a confessor someone she doesn't even know, as far away in her world as possible, from California to New Jersey, She cryptically identifies herself with the initial C so as not even to give herself a name. And then, to ensure her anonymity, she uses a post office box. Do you hear what she is not saying? There are many, many women experiencing this same agony as C, and their numbers are mounting, and you are, even now, and certainly in the future, will be in a great position to help them. Or are you? There are many who feel that a man could never understand what it's like to be pregnant, to plan for or have an abortion, to suffer the emotional, psychological trauma. And they are right. Know it and admit it. But having said that, let me also say I do not believe that it is beyond men, particularly Christian men, to give sympathy to women, to recognize their private and unique feelings, to be concerned about them as hurting individuals, and to enter into their hurt and help them. I emphasize this because so many men, even clergymen, have been intimidated and persuaded by the argument that when it comes to an abortion decision, there is no place for a male voice. You will be party to many moments of rare experience in your ministry that you will never personally know or understand. And a woman and an abortion has got to be one of the rarest. But that doesn't mean you're incapable of helping her, and perhaps, particularly in the abortion issue, may be able to help her far more than anyone else, simply because you are a man and a man of God. So, as we go into some of the problems, you have heard it said, know your hearers. I would say to you on this issue, know your hurters. And we will talk about three classes of hurts. First, women. Secondly, men. Third, relationships, and concluding in the fourth part with some general observations for a counselor. Number one, some observations about aborting women. And I talk in outlines, and if anybody's interested, that's Roman numeral number one, and we will have 4 points under this. Number one. Under Roman numeral one, recognize that women are being conditioned to want and to feel the need for abortion. The research done by the Hastings Institute and articulated by Daniel Callahan, its director, said, it appears from all data and in every country that a change in abortion laws from restrictive to permissive brings forth a whole class of women who otherwise would not have wanted an abortion. Women can be conditioned to want and feel the need for abortion. Subjectively felt stress that leads women to seek an abortion is socially influenced. Unquote. There are many forms of coercion to abort. One tiny little one, for instance, is that there are many banks and mortgage companies which, in order to give a mortgage to a couple bringing in two salaries, will demand that the wife provide a notarized statement that if she becomes pregnant, she will abort. There are health programs that will pay the fees for a single woman who has an abortion, but will not pay the cost of that single woman seeing her child to term. Society has many of those stresses for the woman built in. There are major stresses. One is that the lack of permanence in relationships has played a great part in leading women to feel a need for abortion. In Paul's much maligned passages in Ephesians 5, there's something pertinent there to understanding the 1.5 million women who abort each year. Love your wives, he says. And that speaks to the greatest male weakness and the most fundamental of female needs. Men have, and this is a crazy audience to be saying, isn't it? Men have a natural tendency to avoid commitment, to keep on moving, to avoid interpersonal relationships. And often when they take on a commitment, it is in abstract terms, a commitment to a commitment. This week we had a big series on Robert Mitchum, the star of Winds of War. And the interviewer from the Washington Post asked him about all the booze and broads. And he said, sure, it's true, still true. And he went on about this swinging life he leads. And then the interviewer writes, Mitchum and the former Dorothy Spence have been married for 42 years and have raised 3 children. On the face of it, you would say it is an absurd match. What is their secret? Secret, growls Mitchum. Isn't that the commitment, that you keep doing it for keeps? He's committed to his commitment to be committed. For women, the commitment is a commitment to her, to their children. That supports a woman's core moral and psychological nature. From such a perspective, then, the ultimate male wrong is for her partner to separate himself from her, either physically or psychologically, or for him to be irresponsible in his commitment to her. So in the climate which exists today, in which abortion is promoted as the woman's choice and legally is hers alone, when men say, well, it's your decision, and often without any malice intended, women subconsciously have it register as an abandonment of his responsibility to her and to the child alike. And there is stress to abort from that. Secondly, there is a need to recognize that a near constant found in women considering an abortion or having had an abortion is they have a low self-esteem. Annette Ravinsky, an abortion counselor, an aborting woman herself, a feminist, conducted a survey at the abortion clinic where she works. Strongly present in these aborting women, she concluded, are an intense loneliness and pessimism. When asked if they were glad to be alive, overwhelmingly they responded in the negative. Dr. Eloise Jones, a feminist and a psychiatrist, who, after counseling some 500 women to have abortions, changed her position. She said, an abortion has not helped the self-image of any woman I have talked to. Rather, I have been presented with psychosomatic illnesses, sexual frigidity, all kinds of neurotic disturbances, and deep depression. Abortion strikes at the very nature of a woman as nurturer and guardian of life. In abortion, nature becomes the woman's opponent, for she's denying her basic ability to serve nature's purpose. And as the commercial says, you can't fool Mother Nature. A woman can have an ex-boss, an ex-boyfriend, an ex-husband, but she can never have an ex-child. She can only have a living child or a dead child, but a child, in any case, written forever on her biological consciousness in the deepest recesses of her being. Because of our nature as women, which includes fidelity to our offspring, the destruction of a child deepens any feelings we might have of inferiority or inadequacy. For some, having an abortion is a way of punishing themselves. They don't feel worthy. But others simply don't sufficiently see the sanctity or value of their own lives. So it's painfully logical that they will have difficulty seeing the sacredness of the life within them, which they cannot see at all. The personal pain they know in life, in their own lives, takes precedence over the child whom they do not know. In fact, to see the child within them as beautiful and sacred, while at the same time seeing themselves as ugly and profane, is an emotional contradiction for them. And the latter, their own pain and experience, bears far more weight. And the child must go. Third, the universality of guilt. The Village Voice carried an article by a woman named Suzanne Gordon, who describes herself as a thoroughly liberated female who had an IUD that failed. Quote, "I didn't even call my husband to tell him I was pregnant, nor did I ask his opinion before making an appointment with the local abortionist. There was no question in my mind as to what we would do. My decision to have the abortion was made without the slightest trace of emotional conflict." Yet confident that she was totally in touch with her feelings, she began to experience nightmares about children, and she didn't have any children. She began to have arguments with her husband, and that was very unusual for them. And she continues, "The effects of the abortion were being released into my system day after day. Yet none of this was supposed to happen. The anti-birth technology has brought us pleasure without fear. But it has also brought a very bizarre relationship to our bodies, to the mechanisms relentlessly working inside of us. We have become strange androgynous creatures, half woman and half what? Choose what you will, half man, half human, half soul." Unquote. Repeatedly we are told by abortion clinics and abortionists that there's no guilt, just relief. And I would agree that the most immediate, common emotion after an abortion is that relief. But I know it is very, very temporary. And yet people tend to believe the very people who make their living doing abortion. One of our pastors asked me to do a radio debate in Miami a few years ago. And when I got there, it was one of those typically fair programs, three of them to one of me. And it was a three-hour call-in show. The woman who was most vocal portrayed me as Attila the Hun, while she, on the other hand, was concerned about women's freedoms and women's privacy and women's right to choose and democratic principles, and it was all as American as apple pie. What did not come out over the air, and what I was told I could not mention in the discussion during those 3 hours, was that she worked 2 days a week at a family planning clinic doing abortion referrals. She worked 3 days a week at an abortion clinic assisting in abortion, and her husband was in charge of setting up the abortion clinics for that clinic chain that is based in Florida. Abortion was her business, her only business. And yet, all she would tell women was, there's no guilt, just great relief. A major study recently, done by a number of psychiatrists, concluded that, quote, "guilt and abortion have become synonymous. It is superfluous to ask whether patients experience guilt. It is axiomatic that they will." Takes so many incredibly strange forms. There are the ordinary expressions of guilt, distress, depression, all of those, you know. Then there are the particular expressions of guilt, the nightmares of blood, the dreams of vomiting fetuses, the phobias about cancer of the uterus, and then that eternal nightmare of the phantom child trying to reach that child that is just outside of their grasp. Then there are the indirect expressions of guilt. And when they're presented to a counselor, no one would imagine there'd be any connection to abortion, such as a growing inability of some of these women to be touched by the infirmities of others. There is a hardening of the heart to the point where, in developing a profile of a potential child abuser, the university that's been doing that study found they had to plug in whether or not a woman had had an abortion, because a woman who has aborted a child tends to have a propensity far greater than other women to abuse children who are living. There is a confusion on other moral issues stemming from a previous compromise on the issue of abortion. There's a loss of confidence in decision making because they have come to realize they made the wrong decision for them in the abortion. And some surprising new studies have found that abortion can be the underlying factor in kleptomania, impulsive spending, and psychosis. That guilt exists for secular as well as religious women, and that it takes many forms, is not surprising. What is surprising are the theological rationalizations for abortion, which not only discount the possibility of guilt, but which see abortion as a positive, sacred experience and, in some cases, duty. For instance, an official from the United Church of Christ, speaking at the Planned Parenthood conference last year, said that abortion was morally justified killing because it was a woman's version of the just war theory. A female official from the United Methodist Church, speaking at the conference on women and religion, described her own abortion done while she was married and had two children, but was pregnant as the result of an affair. And she said this: "After the abortion, I felt tremendous healing. Next to my childbirth, this I can truly say was the holiest experience of my life." A Princeton professor, testifying before the legislature in my state, said that the denial of Medicaid funding to a poor woman, quote, "forces her to violate her religious duty because it places a serious restriction on her capacity as a poor woman to do what God intends her to do, which is abort, since God intends that children not be brought into the world indiscriminately." If the mind of an aborting woman becomes hardened through rationalization or suppression, then she may claim that she is not receiving any guilt messages. But numbness to the point of not feeling guilt about destroying one's own prenatal child is a dangerous state of mind. And fourth, triggers for trauma. I didn't know what to call this section. This is very new. When a woman had an abortion 20 years ago, in terms of her environment, it was over. She might still have to grapple with it, but it was buried. It was secret. No one knew, and there was nothing that would cause her to open that all up again, usually. Not so today. All kinds of things in our society that bring that to the front. Okay, 4A. Guilt released by the next pregnancy. We now know that an abortion, for many reasons, has led to increased rates of premature births, spontaneous abortions, death of children because they're born too early, and fetal damage. Here is a woman, pregnant with a child she now wants, but whom she cannot carry to term, and the child dies, or who is born prematurely, and we know that prematurity is the major cause of mental retardation. When the loss of such a baby, or its impairment, is found to be due to damage caused by a previous abortion, then her guilt and anguish can be overwhelming. B, guilt triggered by sterility. It's estimated that there are 3.5 million couples in our country who are not capable of having children. Abortion is a significant factor in those figures. Imagine the guilt such women feel when they discover, first, that they are not capable of having children. That in itself is a monumental problem. But then add to that the fact that the reason they can't stems from an action they took. Add to that the response that is so universal, even for people who are, could be described as very sound people, doctrinally, theologically. Add to those two factors the mentality that says, God is punishing me. I killed one child, now he is not giving me another. And you have a woman with such problems. Incredible. C, guilt triggered by fetal experimentation. Think of the woman's feelings when suddenly she reads or learns of the use of aborted children, kept alive or frozen in experimentation, described like this, done by the doctor at Stanford University, quote, who sliced open the rib cage of a still living fetus in order to observe the heart action. Or the report in Medical World News by a professor from Case Western Reserve who had cut off the heads of live babies delivered through late abortion and then attached the heads to a machine which pumped chemicals through the brain circulation of the severed heads. What images pass through the mind of a woman who has aborted? What guilt is generated when she asks, could that have been my child? D, guilt triggered by the commercial use of fetal materials. Since the Food and Drug Administration has no specific regulations forbidding commercial use of fetal materials, creative entrepreneurs are finding uses for such medical waste, and they're now a big item in cosmetics. Imagine the trauma of a woman who reads of those 17,000 fetal aborted bodies in the container in California, ready to be shipped to a commercial user. Is my child one of those soaking in pickle juice in a plastic container? You see, there are so many things in our environment that shatter the illusion many women have that in abortion their child is somehow painlessly vaporized into another galaxy. But all of these things give concrete form to that blob and gives a place for that body to be. But so much of counseling today, secular and religious, allows for abortion as a valid choice, thereby playing down guilt feelings and dismissing them as part of an archaic value system. Such a counselor will try to convince the woman that there's no reason for her to feel guilty. But that is irrelevant, for the problem is not just feeling guilty. The problem is guilt. But that guilt is not only in women, it is in men. Roman numeral 2. Newspapers last year carried a story of an all-American boy, head of this, that, and the other thing, from a town in Texas, wandering in Daytona Beach, determined to have within him 27 distinct personalities. In studying the case, it was discovered that when this bright young man was a senior in high school, he failed to talk his girlfriend out of an abortion. As a result, he had a major mental breakdown, and his condition has deteriorated in the years that have followed. Surely this is an extreme case, but men too are suffering. And because there is little attention being paid to that kind of trauma, they have begun to put together their own support systems. One such group recently appeared on the Donahue Show. They told how their wives or girlfriends, without their knowledge, and one with his knowledge but not with his agreement, had abortions. And though those abortions had happened a long time ago, they were still in the grief process. And they talked about anger at the woman, grief over the loss of their children, periodic sexual impotence, and an overall feeling of impotence in their lives. All of the relationships that had resulted in an abortion had all since been severed. The usually vocal and opinionated Donahue was the most quiet I have ever seen him. In the presence of the raw pain of these men, he just simply backed away from it, every now and then mumbling an apology. But he couldn't even comprehend the isolation and the guilt these men were experiencing. The limited research that has been done maintains that 72% of those men interviewed expressed some kind of emotional or psychological difficulty. And the researchers and the people who talk about these men have difficulty finding a word to describe them. When we talk about aborting women, we know there are many things an image that's multifaceted that comes from that. But for these men, they can't seem to quite find a way to describe them. Some have called them emasculated men. Some call them victims of abortion abuse. It would appear, and you would know this better than I, that becoming a father is far more complex than simply having intercourse and giving birth to a child. In one sense, it is an ongoing process begun long before pregnancy occurs. It includes having goals and attitudes, defense mechanisms, and many things. And for men, it appears, abortion abruptly arrests this process and results in a role vacuum. Their natural inclination to protect is shattered, is hindered. And so they too, not all, of course, as in any of these things, not every woman, not every man demonstrates these things. But that confusion and guilt and hostility are found in men is becoming more and more apparent. And then the third kind of hurt, Roman numeral 3, relationships. Alienation first from parents. You know, we condition our children to be dishonest. We don't mean to do it. Listen to father who says, if you ever come home pregnant, I'm going to throw you out. Listen to mother who says, would kill me, I'd die if you ever got pregnant. So the young girl says to herself, Mom and Dad verbally taught me always to tell the truth. But through testing, I find they can't handle it. And the 11th commandment, thou shalt not hurt your parents. So, you must always be honest, except when it hurts your parents. And many a girl has had an abortion because Mom or Dad had taught them, and not necessarily meant it, that they couldn't handle that particular truth. Since minors can obtain an abortion easier than they can get a car license, they have been deprived of the decision-making resources of the family bond and have not had a chance to check out whether or not they would be rejected by their parents. But the psychological burden of a secret abortion is overwhelming. It appears to interfere with later heterosexual relationships, and it certainly is playing a major part in the growing statistics of suicide among teenagers. In congressional hearings, an organization named Suiciders Anonymous testified to the direct linkage between suicide attempts and abortion, documenting that in a 3-year period, almost half of all their calls from women were women in the highest suicide rate age group, which is 15 to 24, and that these women callers, one, all had had abortions in this age group, all had had abortions, few had told their parents, and three, many expressed the wish to join the babies they had destroyed. I have found in this delicate human crisis that parents can muster, given the opportunity, being aware can muster great healing power. And there is a regeneration of family closeness that is produced by honesty and openness. But under the law today, parents are denied that opportunity. When couples disagree over a problem pregnancy, abortion promotes dishonesty, denial, and inequality in marital decision making. For some, it signals the end of the relationship. One body of research maintains that 70% of all relationships, married and otherwise, terminate within a month after the abortion. One man expressed the feelings of many in the research when he said, "When I make love to her, it is always on my mind." But even worse than disagreement is that many couples never talked about it. I heard this from my husband. In a number of instances, a couple has come in. They argue. She's saying he has no interest in the home. He's always out. He's always golfing. He's always whatever. And he's saying, she's not at all responsive. I don't get any emotional feedback. And my husband works and works with that and gets all those things ironed out. And they've worked some kind of compromise. He's going to work at this. It's still not working. They go back and they work and work. And lo and behold, way at the bottom is an abortion. And all these years, layers have been built over that. And when they're all taken away, she is saying to herself, unspoken to him all these years, what kind of a man is he? How could he have let me do this when he knew what kind of stress I was under? And he's saying, what kind of a woman have I married who could kill her own child? But it was never talked about. It was something that went on and on and had its own half-life. So while abortion physically affects a woman and an unborn child, psychologically it affects many others. And because of abortion, many relationships are short-circuited and links are missing in both friendships, family ties, and marriages. You see, you can take the tonsil out, can take the appendix out and you're done with it. And people tend, or try, to put abortion in that same category. You're taking the tissue out. But it's just not working. Some say it's the ancient law of sowing and reaping. Others say abortion is really a Trojan horse. It looks like a gift to women until it's entered their lives, and then it's destructive. James Burchill, in an excellent, excellent book, and if you have only one book on the issue of abortion, I would suggest you get this new one called Rachel Weeping. Not only get it, but get somebody to give it to you, because it's $20. And he uses a contemporary illustration for the far-reaching effects of abortion, and he likens them to radioactive wastes buried deep in subterranean storage. Any tremor of the earth may crush the reservoir and let the seething deposit leach out to poison the ground around. Abortion, like these burning wastes, seems something one cannot easily dispose of. And then the last part, some things to consider for a counselor. One, that abortion counseling is crisis counseling. You would not, under other circumstances, support an irreversible action in the time of crisis without protest. The woman whose husband dies and immediately is going to sell her house and move to Florida. The woman who's found her husband having an affair and says, "Pastor, I'm going to get a divorce." You would say, "Wait, give yourself time. This is a crisis." So too is abortion. Plead for time. And secondly, in the abortion crisis, as in no other crisis, it is assumed that the person most immediately involved and most emotionally entangled is best able to make an objective, constructive decision. But a woman seeking an abortion is acting to meet a crisis in her life. But in the name of her right, her privacy, her choice, in effect, she is abandoned to heartless individualism, and repeatedly aborting women say, "If only I'd had someone to stand with me, to say, 'Don't do it,' I'd have grabbed on." Just someone saying, "Don't, wait, think about it," would have made such a difference in the life of that woman and in the death of a child. Secondly, recognize that women may have a difficulty perceiving the problem in a problem pregnancy. She says, "I'm pregnant and I have to get an abortion. I just can't have this baby." Is that the problem? First, determine if it's the condition of pregnancy that's the problem. Will her boyfriend throw her out? Does she have a health problem? Can't she afford the cost? Will she lose her job? One day I had a call from a young man I don't know, and he said, "I work with a girl who's thinking about abortion. Would you talk to her?" And I said, well, sure. How do you know me?" And, well, somehow he'd heard my name. I said, "Do you know how I feel about abortion?" He said, yeah, that's why I want you to talk to her." I said, "Okay, I'd be glad to. When?" He said, "How about midnight?" Okay. Opened the door. It was in the middle of winter, and there stood this girl, her jacket opened, a short mini skirt, and her blouse open here. And the mother in me wanted to go, "Oh, honey, you're going to get your chest cold." And I thought, "Oh, what have I got here?" And she came. It turned out she was a go-go dancer, which was why she was there at midnight. Her job did depend on the showing of this pregnancy. Within 2 months, she knew she just had to get out of that job. Therefore, she had to have an abortion. Well, we worked back and said, "Okay, if you can't work at this job for the next 7 months, is there an alternative?" "Oh, yeah, but I'd have to have income. I'd have to get a job, and I couldn't stay at the club." Well, to make a long story short, we ended up meeting the needs by helping her to isolate the problem. It wasn't that she was going to be out of work. It was that she needed a place to stay. She needed support for those months, and we could meet those needs through people in our church and community. We tend to reduce an abortion problem to simple equations, pregnancy plus abortion equals high school diploma, that sort of thing. But we need to look for the underlying problem by first isolating it, and then by seeking its solution in an integrated way. Third, be prepared to inform her of the risks. Many organizations of women who have been aborted have gathered together, women exploited, they call themselves. And they maintain this, and this is universal in all of these groups. One, they believe they were uninformed or misinformed by their clergymen, by the clinics, and by their friends. They all felt their decision had been made for the convenience and gain of someone else, and they all expressed feelings of having been exploited. You need to tell her the risks. No one else might. Equip your people to counseling. Your most effective counseling may well be secondhand counseling. For with abortion so acceptable today, fewer women are going to counselors. They seek advice from their friends, from their neighbors. Equip your people to counsel so they can do it well. And lastly, know the resources available. No, not lastly, this is five. Know the resources available to assist women with untimely pregnancies. And they have a whole list of things that we don't have time for. And sixth, examine your own heart and motive in your abortion counseling. I debated a Methodist minister, and his response to every question was, I want to help the woman. I want to be able to assist her in her need. When it was all over, I said, how could you have such a myopic view of this whole issue that you immediately say abortion is the solution without looking at all of the other factors in her life and her future? He became livid. He said, you don't know what it's like to counsel. You get these alcoholics and it's on and on for years. You get these marriages and you work years and you never see any results. Ah, a woman comes to me with a problem pregnancy. That I can do something about. Who did he want to help? You, as we laity, are always tempted to try to find loopholes in God's word. But we need to see that we are not free to choose the sins we will identify. It is comfortable to preach today against adultery, drug use, a whole host of things. But many clergy choose not to confront their people or their hurting people with that issue so that they might be healed by the one who can heal them. And then in concluding, women exploited this very militant organization of angry women. Spend time at abortion clinics, trying to persuade women as they go in. They have 1 or 2 minutes to change their mind. What would you use in that precious time? We could not fault them if they would say, listen, I'm sterile because of what happened to me in abortion. We couldn't fault them if they'd say, where is he, the guy who got you this way? Oh yeah, he'll pay the cost of it, but you'll pay the price of this abortion for the rest of your life. That's not what they say. In those precious moments, they ask 3 questions. And they are, do you believe in God? Don't you know that he loves you and loves that child within you? Don't you know that he'll help you in all your difficulties? They don't even wait for answers, but they do show an incredibly high success rate. And maybe it's because all of the research indicates that very, very few women take God into their deliberations about abortion. Many of them have said they assume that if God hadn't wanted them to have an abortion, he'd have stopped them. And that he didn't was taken to be his assent. Well, maybe this confrontation by women exploited at the very last minute is perceived by those aborting women as God trying to stop them. What would be the effect if our counseling was as direct and basic? Last page. You've been wonderfully patient. They gave me an hour and I'm taking 55. We've been dealing here today with a historic and unnerving procedure that does more than annihilate, to use a war word, annihilate bone and tissue. Does more than destroy the psyche of women and men. What is simultaneously aborted is the most intimate of human relationships and the most powerful and pervasive symbol for peace. Someone has said that the genesis of all desire for peace is within the woman, that the taste of peace in the womb accounts for the thirst for peace in the world. Some have said that a nation which destroys the most innocent and defenseless, 4,000 unborn children destroyed each day in this country, that such a nation is not entitled to peace. Rather, I fear such a nation is not capable of peace. As long as we continue to make war on the womb, and destroy the most clear and forceful symbol of peace, then all of the peace movements, all of the peace pronouncements will fail to achieve harmony, for the true nature of peace will remain undiscerned. Can't we, the children of the God, who could have become incarnate in the most tumultuous, uproarious way, but who instead chose to become incarnate in the quiet peace of a woman's womb. Can't we, his children, offer to women with a problem pregnancy more than the death of a child? Of course we can. The really hard question is, do we want to? Thank you.
After hearing Dr. Garten's presentation, I'm sure you can understand why our seminary, as well as our sister seminary in Fort Wayne, has granted Dr. Garten honorary doctor's degrees. As a matter of fact, I believe she's the only person who has ever received a doctorate from both of our seminaries, and she's well deserving of those. Dr. Garten, I think, is quite capable of fielding her own questions and is happy to do that, as she can tell you in some of her stories. She's fielded questions to a lot more hostile groups than this on the topic of abortion. I just wanted to make known to you that the bookstore does have copies of Dr. Garten's book, and she is equally a good writer as she is speaker. There are books available on the credenza back there. The title of her book is Who Broke the Baby? An excellent book dealing with the language used by the abortion movement in trying to promote its cause. The book costs $3 and can be purchased at the door. Dr. Garten?
Good.
Could you quickly relate to us the story of how you got the title of your book, the story with the late at night with the TV on and
Some of you are smiling. I bet you've all read, you all know this story. How many of you don't know that story? Oh, okay. You haven't read the book?
Mm.
I was saying to Dennis, who came early for an interview, that I am the least likely candidate to be involved in this. And I don't mean this as a put-down of myself or other women like me, but until a few years ago, I was the typical housewife. Stay at home, I'd never talk politics, I'd never, you know, nothing. I was so benign, you didn't even know I was around. However, I got pregnant at 40 and didn't want to be. Life begins at 40, right? Some man said that. There I was, and it wasn't my life. We had just finished the seminary. We had gone to the beep beep seminary and had three children, and my husband was placed in his first parish. We were there not 2 months with big bills, all ready for me to get started doing my thing at 40, finally. And I was pregnant. I felt justified in seeking an abortion, and I did. However, it was not legal as it is today. But I felt I had all of the grounds, having had a difficult delivery before, my age, our economic situation, and I tried to find a doctor to do an abortion and could not find any. By the time I diddled around, it had gotten pretty late, and I knew then that it was just too dangerous. But I decided, all right, I'd have to have this baby, but I didn't think any woman had to have a baby she didn't, a pregnancy she didn't want. And the women's movement was shaping up, and I was very interested in rights and equality for women, and I still am. And all of that, it's your body, your right to control, and all of that, just played right into that. So I promised myself that when the child was born, I would join an abortion rights group. Of course, by the time 9 months came, that baby became a very wanted baby. And I think that's why God makes pregnancy 9 months, so you get used to the idea. But I kept my promise to myself and to other women, and I joined a group that was seeking to liberalize the abortion laws. And at the meeting, we were told, never talk about baby, always talk about blobber tissue, never talk about father's rights, only about women's rights, and so on. And I'd come home and I'd say, you know, here my area of training is language. I teach students to look through the doublespeak of politics, of commercials, and that's what I'm doing to promote abortion. If abortion is all of the things I believe it is, I should be able to promote it with language that does not lie. So I sat down and started to research the thing, to develop an argument for abortion that I could use with honesty and integrity. Well, at the end of many months, I either had to change my mind or continue to promote a lie. I finally, one thing led to another, and I joined an abortion, a pro-life group. And one day, I was preparing slides for a presentation to students at a medical school. And so I had on the wall this slide of an aborted child. It was through a DNC abortion, and so you could see the arms and the legs, the torso. I thought all my kids were asleep, and all of a sudden, I felt rather than heard somebody there, and this sharp intake of breath, and this little child saying, "Who broke the baby? Who broke the baby?" Isn't that typically childish? "Who broke that glass? Who broke that plate?" And he looks at this shattered body, pieces, and yet knew instinctively that was a baby. Who broke the baby? And of course, the incredible thing was that that was the baby I sought to break. And so that's how the title came about. There's a P.S. I want to add, since you brought up Don, D-O-N-N. Always have to tell you, for his sake, two N's. A P.S. to that story. I told you before the women saying, God is punishing me for that. You have no idea how logical that is to a woman in that condition. And I thought I would be in that condition, too, if I had aborted Don. Because as some of you know, particularly those from our home congregation, a few years ago, Dean, my planned son, my wanted son, was murdered. And there was Don, such a great comfort to us. But I thought then how God knew back when he sent Don how much we would need him. But had I killed Don because he was unwanted and inconvenient, and then had Dean killed by a man who thought he was unwanted and inconvenient, I'd be a basket case today. And I think that's something you need to take into consideration and try to share with women. At that moment, the crisis is so terrible you can't look beyond, and all we can see is a tiny dot of our lives. But God, who can see the beginning to the end, knows what's ahead. And no one in my wildest dreams would I ever have imagined that this healthy, vibrant, attractive young man that Dean had become would be dead. 3 minutes, you know, just that quick. So, any other question? That's a very important question. One major study has been done on women who have had abortions because of amniocentesis testing, which is inserting a needle into the uterus to determine if there is some genetic problem. These are women who want these babies. But the abortion that follows, if it's determined that the child has a genetic defect, is done late in pregnancy. So other children are aware that mother was pregnant and now no longer is. Psychologists have studied those children in those families and have determined that the abortion created, a permanent but subtle fracture in the trusting relationship. The child or children had two unspoken questions. The first was, would mother have done that to me if I had had something wrong with me? And what do you think the second one is? Will mother do that to me if I get something wrong with me? Now, imagine, those are very small cases. Imagine all of the children in all of these homes whose mothers are aborting because the child is inconvenient, untimely, economically burdensome, the wrong sex, whatever. What are the hidden questions of this whole generation of children? I think we will get the answer to that in very negative ways in the future.
Maybe the whole general population of children who are aware that this is going on, perhaps not in their family, but do they in any way feel perhaps disenfranchised from family?
I think it has affected. We are dealing now for the first time, with a whole generation of children who have never known anything but abortion. It affects their attitude about older people. You begin to see the hearings they're holding in Washington on the attacks, vicious attacks, of children on adults. It sets into motion a whole way of dealing with other human beings.
Could you give any sort of typical profile of a lady who had an abortion, for example? Would they be more likely to be married than not married? Or
the latest statistics just came out this week. They come out from the Center for Disease Control, and you need to understand, when you hear these statistics, even from the government, most states do not require reporting. So when they tell us that we are having 1.3 or 5 million abortions a year, take into consideration that an overwhelming number of abortions are not reported and not required to be reported. But on the basis of what they have, They said 70% of the women aborting were white, 75% were unmarried, 58% of the women had never had live births, 3% had four or more live births, 30% were 19 or younger, 35% were 20 to 24, and 35% were 25 or older. Is that what you were asking? Mm-hmm. Okay, there.
Earlier you mentioned the Donahue program, his reference to men being the emasculated and the victims of abortion abuse. In light of those statistics that you just mentioned, it seems to me that men are a part of the victimizing of the abortions that apparently have a tendency to be growing in our country. I would wonder, my question would focus on the need possibly for our parishes, our seminaries, to be dealing with human sexuality and teaching it in such a way that young men who are the other half of that problem of abortion, somehow can we better prepare ourselves as pastors to deal with not only young men and young women, but all men and all women about their sexuality. Mm-hmm. We often play a part in that responsibility.
I think you're definitely right. Let me correct you about one thing. It was not Donahue who used those two phrases. It comes out of research of trying to describe these men. Yes, you're absolutely right. I know of pastors who, in their marriage counseling, plug in this whole area of pregnancy by using a film, and there are newer and perhaps better ones, called The First Days of Life, which shows a developing child so that before these people even place them themselves in a position, hopefully before they are, to have children, I'm the eternal optimist, they will have understood the nature of, you know, bringing a child into being and seeing his humanity from the very early stages. We are in the process of trying to get a pastor to develop for us a unit for confirmation training that each pastor could slip in and anywhere he wants, the Fifth Commandment or wherever. We at this point, Lutherans for Life, is sponsoring its first conference on counseling men and women. That hasn't been done in the Christian community. It's going to be in June 25th in Minneapolis, but we have scheduled, hopefully with assistance from the Synod, four more next year for clergy and teachers. How can we get at this in our parishes? So what you're talking about points to a very real and practical need. Over here. Yes.
This is not concerning counseling, but ideally, what do you feel should be the role of a parish pastor concerning abortion?
Ideally. I would hope, first of all, the pastor would equip himself. When you leave here, you will surely participate in seminars on alcoholism, on death and dying, on administration in the church, on evangelism. You know that there are specific needs that cannot be met at the seminary, although they're touched on. So too, you need to do your homework on this issue. So that's number one, an informed clergyman is so vitally important. And then educate your own people on the issue. Synod recently had a Respect Life Sunday. Its purpose was not to focus on abortion, but to focus on the gift of life and to emphasize the value of that life. Overwhelmingly, it did not happen in the churches, in our church body. And when we recognize the absolute that says all bottlenecks are at the top. You have to say, why didn't it happen in that church? Why weren't people led to, you know, an awareness about life and a need for an appreciation of life? So that's number one. Number two, then educating. But in your, I guess, dealing with young people, in your schools, in your Sunday schools, our Sunday schools could play such a vital role in it. Take that story of Samson. All the kids know it. They know the long hair. They know the pillars. They know the eyes. They know that. Why isn't more made of the fact that God said Samson is to be a Nazarite from his mother's womb and placed on the mother the restriction she was not to eat or drink certain things? What does that say about God's view of when Samson's life began? What is that application to your life and mine? Why don't we build into our dialogue on this words and phrases that reinforce the concept of life beginning at the beginning? Why doesn't a pastor someday say, let's have a conception celebration? Would that be so terrible? Darn right it would. Why don't we stop saying, oh, Mary is expecting? Petula Clark, the comedian, was on a Lucille Ball special, and she waddled in, obviously, in that way. And Lucy said, oh, Petula, I heard you were expecting. And she said, oh, you Americans, why do you call it expecting when the border has already moved in? So by our very words, we deny what intellectually we know. So I guess I'm saying, you know what I said. Okay, over here and then Jack.
When we minister to people out there, there are going to be people, women who have inevitable abortions or miscarriages. Are the hurts very similar? Do they feel the same kind of guilt? Do they require the same kind of caring?
Well, you see, yes. Yes, in that sense. In fact, a lot of women who miscarry just, you know, feel it's because of something they've done. And recently, it may well be, in light of the alcohol and aspirin and drug-related problems that we're seeing in connection with miscarriages. Yes, that is true. I have found that many women who have had abortions in particular and have been healed of the hurt want in turn to be life givers. Those women can be the greatest asset to a pastor. They are like the women who have had mastectomies, who go minister to women who have mastectomies. We passed out from Lutherans for Life the story of a Lutheran woman who would not tell this story for a long time. She is now the one who has just pleaded for these counseling workshops that we're doing. She's been a tremendous help to us understanding the problem. So, yes, there will be women there. Try to identify them in order that you can minister to them, but that they then in turn can minister to other women. Jack, same question. Okay?
One last one.
One last one. Yes.
Has there been any study applying to the rape victim and how she goes through? Does she go through many of the same stages and problems?
A rape victim needs specialized and sensitive counseling. What is interesting is psychiatrists are telling us now that they do not know in advance for which woman an abortion after rape is the thing that puts her over the emotional brink. We've always said, abort that woman for her good. And now they're saying, no, that may not be for her good. Because in the abortion, in the rape, she is the victim. And that has a whole set of trauma. But when we engage her in an abortion, we then do a role reversal and she becomes the aggressor. And that carries with it a whole set of trauma and complicates the problem. One last quick story. I was at one of our churches in the Bronxville, New York area. At that point, as I was working my way back, I was still holding out on the rape issue, abortion for rape. And a woman there said, would you come home with me? I want you to meet my daughter. She wouldn't give me any more information. Well, finally, I decided to go. And In bed was a woman then about 40, 45, very unattractive and incredibly handicapped. She went on to tell me the story that she had always been this way, had never been able to go to school, had lived a very sheltered life, but she obviously had a very good mind. And one night, her parents were out, she was in bed, and a man broke in to rob, which he did. And then he found her in bed, and he proceeded to rape her. And the most incredible of incredibles, she became pregnant. And that's incredibly, incredibly rare in forcible rape. Of course, everybody said she had to abort. Her pastor, her parents, her doctor, everybody. And her condition was such they could have picked her up, taken her, and aborted her. She had no way to control any action from her waist down. The sheer power of her faith kept them from doing it. She said, "This man intended evil, but God can bring good out of that." She said, "I would never have been able to have had a child. No man would have looked at me or wanted me." She said, "But God blessed me through what was a great, great problem." And then she called in this 12-year-old boy, was the light of her life, was solving the parents' problem, who was going to take care of her after they were gone. And it taught me a lesson about rape, that God never said that we had to be conceived in love to have value in his sight or to be able to serve him. He never said we had to be, you know, conceived in the Hilton or instead of, you know, on a, well, no, well, wherever those things take place. But what that woman did need and did get then when she said no was incredibly sensitive, supportive, and specialized counseling. It is different from other kinds of pregnancies. Okay?
Thank you again so much, Dr. Gardner.